Join the National U Institute for our Foundations of Freedom Regional Seminars in California. We're stopping in Newport Beach on April 30th and then in San Jose on May 1st. These half-day conferences take place from 2:30 to 6:30 p.m. and feature me, Rich Lowry, and Ramesh Panuru, along with Judge Janice Rogers Brown, John Yu of Berkeley Law, and Will Swaim of the California Policy Center. Register at nrinstitute.org. That's nrinstitute.org. Hope to see you there. Welcome to the McCarthy Report, the podcast where I, Rich Lowry, discuss with Andy McCarthy the latest legal and national security issues. This week, what else? The Trump ballot access case at the Supreme Court. If for some reason you're not already following us on a streaming service, by the way, you can find us everywhere from Spotify to iTunes. And please give this podcast and Andy McCarthy the glowing, indeed gushing, five-star reviews that they deserve on iTunes. Now, without further ado, I welcome to this very podcast, through the miracle of Riverside, none other than Andy McCarthy.
Rich, how are you?
Good, Andy. How are you?
I'm good. I'm just back from Washington, which is like never been my favorite city on the planet. I managed to work for the federal government for over a quarter of a century and not get assigned down there, although I had a few close calls. I just think it's a weird city. It's got a very weird vibe.
My dad was a native New Yorker, but lived in Northern Virginia for, I don't know, 40 or 50 years, but just always had contempt for D.C. as a podunk, backwards, second-rate town compared to New York.
Yeah. I think it as I've gotten older, whenever I go down there, which is fewer and further times between than it used to be, but it's so overtly in-your-face political. And I've always thought it was weird that you get into a taxi and like the public radio station is the soundtrack of Washington.
It's really true.
Anyway.
All right. So, but I'm sure the cab drivers have public radio tuned in Washington, D.C. right now discussing the Super Tuesday results. What were your quick takeaways before we get to the Supreme Court decision?
Well, I think it's what everybody expected. It pretty much tracked the polls. I guess if I were Haley, I'd be disappointed because I think she said had some glimmer of maybe breaking through in Virginia, and she did get Vermont. But like every place she gets is a it's because Democrats and Independents got to vote. But I just think I know the tide is turning and the polls. I can't believe the two polls that. That you highlighted on the corner earlier, probably a few days ago, where he's actually gotten over 50%. One, I think, was a CBS poll, was it?
Yeah, CBS.
One was I'm not buying it, but if he continues to break 50, then we'll see. And I'll have to, reassess and eat crow because I've said he can't win. But I would just say this. I still think it's a dynamic situation that's going to get much worse. I think we're going to talk today about part of the reason why it's going to get much worse, namely, Jack Smith's scheme to try him from Labor Day through Election Day. But I think if I'm, he talks about what sweeping victories these are, and maybe they are, but if he's running as a quasi incumbent, it looks like, depending on which state you go to, he's got a 20 to 30% structural problem, a goodly chunk of which in his own party are never going to support him. Never. And it's just not – I think it'd be foolish 9 years into this now to think he's going to suddenly change his way and reach out to those people. Everything I see from – the way that Lara Trump is moving in on the RNC to the rhetoric that we hear from people like, J.D. Vance, who himself didn't support Trump, is now like threatening people that he's got a long memory and, people don't come on board. And you're getting this vibe from them that, if you're not on the Trump train, you're out of the party. And I just think this is like so the wrong approach. You can't bludgeon people. What it does is it hardens their position. And I don't see Rich in the end in what's going to be a very close race. And where I, you know, we talked about my old Torricelli story. I don't put anything past the Democrats. I think if they think they're going down in flames, they're going to find a way to switch Biden out if he's the problem. But I just don't see how Trump can win this election with close to 20% of his side not coming out for him.
20%, you mean the Haley vote?
I mean, it's not necessarily – like, I wouldn't consider myself a Haley voter.
Yeah.
I would have been a DeSantis voter. But I would not vote for Trump because I thought he should have been impeached. So, I think he should have been disqualified. Mm-hmm. And the fact that I would vigorously defend him in connection with these criminal cases has less to do with him than it does with the fact that I'm like a person from that system who's offended by the idea of it's being politicized in this way. And I think we're going to really come to regret it. And that's going to be a much bigger problem than Trump. But I think he needs every single vote to squeeze past Biden. And I think a lot of people are simply not going to vote for him. And look, Biden's got a problem on the other end, right? It's going to be, is the never Trump vote canceled out by the never Israel vote that they have on the, if you look at these returns, people look at Minnesota and say, wow, one in five voters were non-committed in that primary, in the Democratic primary. Well, that's not that hard to understand. It's like Somaliland in the Twin Cities. And every place where there is, strong pockets of the Muslim vote, Biden's hurting. Mm-hmm. And it's because there's very strong – I'd like to think that was, the anti-Israeli thing was a fringe in Democratic politics. It's not. It's a strong current. And as you go, whether you analyze it ethnically or age-wise, especially with young people, this is going to be a big problem for Biden because he needs those voters too. So – look, I heard it was Sean or somebody said last night, we got 244 days of this to come. I guess we're down to 243, Rich, so that's good.
it's going to be the longest general election campaign ever and feel longer.
Yeah, yeah. So look, maybe I'm totally wrong, but I just don't see how he wins without those people.
I was talking to Megyn Kelly about this on her show just a little while ago. There's a disconnect because you look at the persistence of the Haley vote and, it's not what it was in New Hampshire and South Carolina states where she could kind of worked it pretty hard and matched up either she was from there or ideologically it was favorable terrain for her. But she's gone down to 25 or 30. But I don't think you can draw a straight line from that to that's the nut Trump has to crack. Because you look at the national polling and both Trump and Biden are about equal in terms of their support among Democrats and Republicans. I was just looking at a morning consult poll because I just want to check my memory. 87% both Democrats support Biden, 87% support Trump. Others have them, 90-91%. So it's Trump does have a party problem and a unity problem, and he certainly should be acting like it's a serious problem. It's just ridiculous. He wasn't saying nice things about Nikki Haley. Not that all these voters will go where Nikki Haley goes. I think very few of them will, but still just as a sign,
right.
Anyone on the fence matters.
Just think he's misdiagnosing this, which he always does because he always thinks it's all about him. But if I'm right that those over 50% polls are going to be outliers and we're not going to see that very much, the truth of this is he's about where he always was. He's somewhere 46 to 48, right? And the swing in the election is that Biden was up here and now he's had a 10-point swing the other way. So it's really not about Trump. It's about Biden and how much of that he can claw back. Or if they have the nerve to switch him out if he's done for.
Yeah. So let's talk about the Supreme Court. We had this 9-0 decision, at least formally. You've noted that there is significant dissent within this 9-0 decision, but your kind of big picture takeaways.
Well, just on the dissent point, did you see the bit about how they left the coding in the decision? No. Oh, so evidently I had to ask
you anything.
I had to ask Charlie about this yesterday because he knows so much more about this than I do. But like he talked about like how you have to sort of compress the file. But somebody figured out like in the joint opinion, it says Sotomayor, Kagan, and Jackson, JJ, concurring, concurring. And somebody figured out that if you copied the JJ and then hit Control P, you know, pasted it onto another document, what comes up is Sotomayor J concurring in part and dissenting in part. So that was what the original that what became that joint opinion was originally a partial dissent by Sotomayor, which we should know, but they left the underlying coding for people who are savvy at that stuff.
So what's the deal with not having an unsigned opinion?
So when it's a case where the court wants to speak with one voice, and sometimes this is because it's an important case, and then other times this happens a lot, Rich, like I see like a lot of court of appeals opinions where they just don't think much of the appeal. And it's not like one of these cases where I guess the judge who's going to author the opinion feels like he's writing for the ages or she is. So what they say is per curiam, which means basically it's the court speaking.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like we could put per curiam on our editorials, for example. You know,
not always.
but in a case like this one, where I think they thought it was really important to project that they had unity about this.
Yeah.
What they wanted to do was have an unsigned opinion that spoke for the court, which creates, I think in this case, the illusion that the court is speaking with one voice, because if you read these opinions, the court is not speaking with one voice.
So that coding would suggest that originally you had a couple of dissents and then they were convinced, no, we won't be dissents, we'll just have this.
Yeah, I bet that the holdup and the suddenness of announcing that that the decision, you know, remember it was all of a sudden we heard the night before that the court was suddenly going to announce some opinions, and everybody figured it's probably this one. And the reason, by the way, so people understand, it wasn't random that we thought it was going to be this decision. Colorado was one of the Super Tuesday states, so it was clear that the court wanted to get this decision out before March 5th. So we heard on the night of March 3rd that it was going to be out on March 4th. They obviously wanted everyone to know that like Trump was legitimately on the ballot in Colorado, and they weren't going to change their mind sometime after the fact. So they obviously set themselves a deadline to get it out. And I bet that there's a lot of behind the scenes negotiating where they didn't want any dissents. And I think Sotomayor wanted to write a dissent because she was offended, not by the narrow point on which, when we talked about this after the oral argument, I really thought it was going to be a 9-0 decision, because I thought that Roberts would keep it narrow. And even though Sotomayor was the one justice that day at the oral argument who seemed a little bit sympathetic to the Colorado side, the point she was not sympathetic on was the most narrow way that you could look at this, which is, can a state remove not just any official, but the president from, or a presidential candidate from the ballot? Even she seemed to have trouble with the idea that that could be done. But she, I thought, was more sympathetic to the idea that maybe states had the power to invoke their own processes with respect to other officials, but not the president. The president was a bridge too far for her. So I thought it was going to be a very, very narrow 9-0 decision on that point. But I have to say, Roberts, and this goes to Roberts's agenda, which is to keep the court out of as much trouble as he can keep the court. He decided, and the five other or the four other conservatives who went with him. Barrett did not go with him, and which is an interesting opinion too. But what they decided is that if you make the ruling that everyone agreed on, that the states didn't have the power to do this, that doesn't take away the power of Congress to do it. Everybody understands that under Section 5 of the 14th Amendment, Congress has the power to enact laws that would implement the 14th Amendment. And on the left of the court, they went even further than that. They said there doesn't need to be anything to implement the 14th Amendment because it's self-executing. When we're talking about Section 3, the disqualification provision, like Kagan says, why does the disqualification provision need legislation to implement it? We didn't have legislation to implement the Equal Protection Clause. You know, there's nothing that says you have to implement the Due Process Clause. Defendants get to invoke those if they get prosecuted. So, you know, there's a strong position for that this Section 3 provision does not need implementing legislation. But Roberts, going back to how this all played out in 1870 in what's called Griffin's case, and it's written by Chief Justice Salmon Chase, even though he was not writing as a Supreme Court justice at the time. But what he said was basically for this disqualification provision in Section 3 to be activated, Congress needs to enact legislation to implement it. And acting on that opinion, in 1870, Congress did implement legislation. And the bottom line is there was once a civil provision that went with this, but they repealed that in the 1940s, not for any reason that anyone can lay their hands on confidently. It seems to be they just did an overhaul of the federal code and some stuff fell out, including that. But the one thing that comes down to us from this period of time is the law in the federal penal code, section 2383, that makes it a crime to engage in insurrection. So what the court is essentially saying is the only way Congress has implemented this so far that's still on the books is you have to convict somebody of insurrection under the federal penal code. And obviously, I think the reason Roberts did that is he was afraid that if Trump wins the election, what's going to happen on January 6th of 2025 is the Democrats were going to come in and try to not ratify Trump's victory on the grounds of Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, arguing that he's a insurrectionist. So I think if that had happened and there had been litigation, now you have the Supreme Court squarely in the position of picking the president. I mean, basically, it's like the nightmare thing for them is Trump's been elected, Democrats won't ratify him, and are the conservatives, including the three conservatives that Trump put on the Supreme Court, going to step up to the plate and bat the Democrats down and let him take the presidency? And Roberts and those guys, I think, didn't want any part of that. So what they basically said is the only thing that's on the book for now is the criminal provision. Nobody's been convicted of insurrection under that. And obviously Congress has the authority to enact legislation if they want to come up with a different way of enforcing it. We used to have the civil remedy of enforcing it, but they have to pass that. And the court, of course, knows that this divided Congress is never, ever going to be able in the short term to do that.
So this decision is attempting to foreclose the option of Democrats refusing to certify on the grounds of Trump's. How possibly does the court have that power? Can't just a congressman conclude that this guy's an insurrectionist and is illegitimate, therefore I'm not going to certify? And who's going to stop me from doing that?
Well, be interesting to see if they do. Now, if it was a president who was pushing back against a Supreme Court opinion like that, you'd have any number of people in Congress saying, you know, he ought to be impeached because the Supreme Court's the last word on what the Constitution says, right? But what the Supreme Court is saying here is that the correct way to interpret Section 3 of the 14th Amendment is that Congress has to enact implementing legislation.
Mm-hmm.
And the only legislation, they're not saying that there can't be some other kind of legislation. What they're saying is under current law, the only legislation that implements the disqualification provision in Section 3 is the criminal statute that makes it a crime to engage in insurrection, and Trump hasn't been convicted of that.
Mm-hmm.
But the other thing to recognize, Rich, is that the problems don't end with January 6th. Let's say, you know, the Democrats fold and Trump takes office, right? The next thing is
they don't have the power to block him, right? They don't have a majority in the House, or that they do in the Senate. So I guess you could have, would it be the Senate? So, but if one House blocks, he's still certified, right? You need both houses to reject.
Yeah. Well, yes, you'd have to do it under the provisions of the Electoral Count Act,
uh-huh.
and the 12th Amendment. And I don't think they have the votes. It's two different questions here. One is, do they have the votes for any reason to refuse to count the state's certified votes? And then relatedly, is a basis for doing that he's disqualified under Section 3 of the 14th Amendment? And as you point out, you know, if this was just a law school exercise, you'd say, well, look, the court said that, you know, the only way to implement this in current law would be to convict him of insurrection, and that's not going to happen, so therefore he gets to take office. That just assumes that Congress is going to accept what the court has done here, which I think they will. But like, there, we understand that Zoe Lofgren and Jamie Raskin and Eric Swalwell are all working on legislation, which I think will get obviously batted down. It won't go anyplace. But they're working on legislation to create a civil procedure that would enable the disqualification provision to be enforced. I actually think, you know, logically speaking, that may undermine them, because the fact that they're doing that exercise indicates that they understand from the court's opinion that they have to do something to implement the amendment.
I don't see why they wouldn't be able to say, you know, he's practically, you use the McConnell formulation, he's practically and morally responsible for what was practically and morally insurrection, so we're not voting to certify him. I don't understand how the Supreme Court has any power to stop me from, as a senator or a congressman, from saying or doing.
Well, you could do that as a senator or a congressman, Rich, but the thing is, you have to carry Congress with you, right? So there's an overwhelming amount of Congress which will say the Supreme Court has spoken here, mm-hmm. and they're saying you need to convict them. And you guys are as much the people who are pushing this, like Raskin and Lofgren and Swalwell, you know, the McConnells, McConnell won't be there anymore, but whoever is, you know, pushing back in the other direction, Ted Cruz or Mike Lee or whoever, is going to say, you guys know that this is the law because you're trying to you're trying to legislate a new procedure.
Even if it were just, let's say the court hadn't said anything, and or the court had said it's in Congress's power without, you know, someone doesn't have to be convicted of the Insurrection Act, whatever that decision would look like, hypothetically. But
you mean it's self-enforcing?
Yeah. So, you'd still need majorities of Congress, right, to disqualify him.
Correct. But now they wouldn't have a Supreme Court decision to fight against.
Mm-hmm.
Now they have a Supreme Court decision, and you got the Democrats, you got Nancy Pelosi saying it's like the voice of God came down. The Supreme Court spoke, right? Mm-hmm. When it goes their way, it's like the Supreme Court's the last word on the law, man. That's the end of it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's going to be much harder for anyone who would have said, we're not going to count the electoral votes of, say, Alabama because Trump's an insurrectionist. It's going to be hard for them to do that when they'd have to push through a Supreme Court law or Supreme Court decision that says no. But I think the thing that the Supreme Court really doesn't resolve here, we'll see, it'll be interesting, is let's assume for argument's sake that Trump wins and they ratify his victory on January 6, 2025. Then he becomes president. He issues his first executive order telling somebody to do something, which affects somebody's rights. And that person goes into court and says, he's an insurrectionist. He can't do that to me. You know, in other words, I'm now suing because it's an invalid order because he's not eligible to be president. And he's using the powers of the presidency in a way that hurt me as a, you know, an executive official or as an American citizen whose interests have been harmed by what the president has done. The next question then that's going to flood the court is everything he does, is there a difference between the offensive and defensive application of Section 3? Mm-hmm. In other words, it's one thing to say you can't disqualify him. It's another thing if you're a person who is harmed by something he does. So, for example, remember the case involving the labor commissioner, where it turned out that you had remember Obama tried to appoint someone without approval of Congress, and then they got sued because they hadn't been confirmed by Congress as the law mm-hmm. requires. And in that case, the Supreme Court ruled in favor of the people who said they'd been harmed because the person was not a legitimate federal actor. So I think what you're going to get, if he wins, the next round is going to be people who are negatively affected by presidential actions going into court to sue that say he's not qualified to be president and I'm therefore being harmed by somebody who's not eligible to be in the office. So we may have a whole bunch of litigation about that. Now, the court could take this decision that they just made and said, no, we're going to apply the same logic of that. He hasn't been convicted of insurrection. But buckle your seatbelts because there's more to follow here.
So is it the court's position that if Trump was convicted of being an insurrectionist, but Congress had not passed legislation saying, you know, you as a state can ban him, that he still couldn't be banned by the state?
No, if he had been convicted, they could have gone in and removed him from, because then the state would be able to say, we're invoking the procedure that Congress enacted to enforce the disqualification provision, namely the criminal process. So what they would say is essentially Congress's enactment of what is now Section 2383 of the Penal Code, the insurrection statute, that's consistent with, as the court said, its power under Section 5 of the 14th Amendment to enforce the Section 3 disqualification provision. So a state would be able to, like, if Colorado, instead of doing their own procedure, which was their own ad hoc thing, that as, remember, the court said that, are we going to have 50 different states with 50 different rules? Like in one state, Justice Barrett pointed out, in one state, like Colorado, they admitted into evidence a lot of the January 6th committee's report, which was a bunch of hearsay and, it had never been evaluated on whether it was admissible or not under the federal rules of evidence. Barrett said, are we going to have 50 different, like some states say it's okay to put this in, some states don't, some states got, in some places it's the court that kicks you out, in some places it's an election official. If they had, instead of having that process that they made up as they went along, if Trump had been convicted in federal court of insurrection and Colorado, either voters in Colorado or the Secretary of State of Colorado had come in and said, here's a judgment of conviction from federal court that certifies that this guy's that he engaged in insurrection, that would be it. They would be able to keep him off the ballot.
So, and at that point, the patchwork problem is no longer a problem. Like you can have Colorado and Maine disqualifying him because he's been convicted, but it's okay if he's on the ballot other places.
Well, it's okay, but you know, Congress wouldn't seat him. You know, Congress wouldn't validate it if he was convicted.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it'd be an if he was. Well, I don't. You know, no, I'm not sure about anything anymore. But if he had a criminal conviction for insurrection, I think it would be an insuperable problem.
Yeah. So, and then finally, before we move on to other stuff, so is the majority correct or the dissenters correct that they went too far?
Well, I think they're correct. I don't think that this is self-executing, and I think you do need a process under Section 5. It doesn't necessarily have to be a criminal process, but criminal process is the only thing that they've enacted. But in saying that, Rich, I don't want to completely poo-poo the dissent, because I think they actually made a lot of good points with respect to whether this is self-executing or not. And, you know, Justice Kagan did this during the oral argument as well. There's a lot of stuff in the 14th Amendment that we've deemed to be self-executing. And, you know, I read a pretty interesting piece at the Volokh Conspiracy today by our friend Josh Blackman about how it, you know, how it could be differently interpreted whether somebody was in an offensive position or a defensive position. Like if you were trying to enforce the 14th Amendment against Trump, you would have to show that the process that Congress had enacted had been followed, and then you could enforce it. But if you were in a defensive position, like if the government took action against you, there's a good argument that if, you know, for a defensive invocation, there's a lot of situations in the law where we do consider the constitutional provisions to be self-executing. You know, like, for example, if the government tried to search your home without a warrant, and without due process, we don't say that the Fourth Amendment right against that is not operative unless Congress enacts some legislation. The Constitution says they can't do it. That's the end of it, right? So if you're in a defensive posture, there's an argument that there's a different rule that applies. But it's, you know, it's not the easiest area of the law. I think our conversation shows that, because, you know, every time you try to, you think you've got it nailed down, you think of another iteration of it that has a lot of complexity to it. So, you know, occasionally I think that these decisions come out and it seems to me that one side is completely right and one side is completely wrong. I think in this case, you know, the dissent has a case. And the one thing, you know, this I think is why we get to, if I could just say, like, 2 minutes on or less on Justice Barrett. Justice Barrett didn't sign off on with the three progressive justices, but she didn't join the majority. And her point was, this is a really complicated area. It's very fraught politically, and we shouldn't do anything more than we have to do to decide this case. And the only thing we have to say to decide this case is that the states don't have the power to do that. And we ought to wait as far as, you know, whether we go further than that, we ought to wait till the next case comes up and then deal with it then. And my problem with what Justice Barrett said is that she made a big to-do about how, you know, when we're deciding cases that are so fraught in a intense political season, we don't want to add stridency to the problem. It's hard enough to decide these things already. And there's a lot in her decision that seems to me like she's overly worried about how the court is perceived. Whereas I think they just have to decide what they need to decide. And that's the reason we insulate them for politics in the first place. We don't want them worried about how their decisions are going to be received. And I think if she's worried about stridency, what Roberts' pushback would be is just wait until Trump gets elected and we haven't made the decision that we made. And then the Democrats want to block him by saying he's an insurrectionist. And it's still up in the air whether this is self-executing or whether you have to get somebody convicted under current law. And then the Supreme Court's in the position of picking the president.
Yeah.
At least that's the way. That's
better to do it beforehand, assuming it's correct on the law.
Right.
All right, so let's pause really quickly. Do a plug for NR Plus digital subscription service at nationalreview.com. Your way around our metered paywall. Your way, if you sign up and log in, to see about 90% fewer ads, especially the most obnoxious and annoying ads. Your way, if it floats your boat, to comment on our articles and blog posts and get invited to exclusive calls and events with our writers, editors, and other conservative figures. And most importantly, it's a really crucial way to support our valuable journalism. So all sorts of reasons. It's overdetermined why you should become a member of NR Plus. So please consider signing up today, tomorrow, or the day after. So Andy, you had a really astonishing, not all your columns are astonishing, but this was even more astonishing than usual, just on the schedule that Jack Smith has in mind for our friend Donald Trump to kind of keep him tied down, you know, all during the most intense traditional period of the election season. What's going on here?
Well, I think, Rich, that the there was so much going on last week that something that was really important escaped a lot of notice. Didn't completely escape notice, but it's just we all have only so much bandwidth, and you know. Sometimes things that are maybe more important than other things don't seem as pressing, so they don't get the attention they ought to. But in what seemed to be a fairly benign sounding proceeding down in Florida, namely, it was basically a scheduling, I don't even want to call it a hearing, a scheduling conference, because the case in Florida, this is the Mar-a-Lago documents case, is mired in SEPA litigation, the Classified Information Procedures Act.
Can't wait till we get into the weeds of SEPA.
Oh, but yeah, it's fabulous.
Awesome.
But in the course of all, in the midst of this, you know, basically they're trying to come up with what the trial date's going to be. And it seems obvious to me that they're not going to have a trial this year, just because this is very hard to get through. But in the midst of all this, Jack Smith, the presumptive trial date that they have, or what I should call the nominal trial date, is May 20th, which everybody knew was never, ever going to happen. I mean, they're nowhere on the classified discovery and all of the admissibility proceedings that they have to have under this. And you can even have appeals after all that's done. So the thought that they were going to have a case or have a trial here May 20th was ridiculous. But the next thing that, you know, the judge doesn't want the thing to go off the rails. So she asks the parties to propose a trial date. So Smith proposes July 8th. And Trump counters that I don't want to propose a trial date, because it gets too close to the election. I have a right not to, I shouldn't be, you know, tied down with this while I'm running for election. It's not right that this goes before and the judge basically says to him, yeah, I understand that's your position, but I need, you know, we're keeping a date here. So propose a date. So then I think Trump's team does what I regard to be a tactical blunder. And that is, they say, okay, fine. We propose August 12th as the date for this 2 to 3 month trial.
Why? Why?
Why would they do that?
Yeah.
Okay. They would do that because if you regarded this as a real exercise, right, that like they actually thought that there could be, you know, that we have to indulge the fiction that there could be an August 12th trial, so that's how the court schedule has to be arranged And that's how all the lawyers have to arrange their calendars and all that stuff. What Trump's team is figuring is if we lock in an August 12th date here, then Judge Chutkan will never be able to schedule the January 6th trial. Because we all know with the January 6th trial, everything is frozen until the Supreme Court decides the immunity claim, right? And then the other moving target there is the obstruction case that they're also going to decide, and how much that how much of a bomb that is on Smith's indictment. So what Trump is figuring is if we indulge the fiction that we're going to have a 2 to 3 month trial in the Mar-a-Lago documents case starting August 12th, then Chutkan's blocked out. And she can't have a trial before Election Day. And I think, you know, what Trump wasn't banking on is nobody thinks that the scheduling that they're doing in the Mar-a-Lago case is real. So Judge Chutkan's going to go ahead and schedule the trial when she can schedule the trial. And now when they schedule the trial, when Trump objects because that's going to run right into Election Day, both Smith and Judge Chutkan are going to be able to say, wait a minute, you proposed an August 12th trial in Florida for a case that was going to run it through October. So I think this was like tactically, it was a bad, they were too clever by half as usual. But while this volleying is going back and forth, Judge Cannon, who of course is the Trump appointee, says to Smith's team, what about the 60-day rule? What about this Justice Department 60-day rule where, you know, you guys take the position that you don't want to take any action that could influence the outcome of an election? And now we're talking about, like, you know, trial dates in August, trial dates in September. So this is the part that didn't get much play, but I think deserves to be highlighted. And that is Jack Smith's lawyers, who are running the case down in Florida, says that Jack Smith has decided that the 60-day rule is not operative with respect to Trump.
Yeah, it's so well known.
Well, so they explained, and this is
your view of Trump, Andy. It's all baked in the cake.
But think about how logically ridiculous this is. So first of all, you know, what they tell the judge is, the thing is, Trump's already been indicted. So like everybody already knows what he did and what he's accused of. So in that instance, we don't worry about the 60-day rule, because the 60-day rule is about like not taking any overt actions against somebody who hasn't been charged yet that leaves voters to think that maybe he's under suspicion of the government. Here, everybody knows what he's suspected of.
So as long as you're indicted, the 60-day rule doesn't apply, as long as you're already indicted.
Yeah, so here's my question, Rich, and I wish Judge Cannon had asked this. Then what's the big rush of getting him tried and convicted prior to Election Day? If everybody already knows everything, why are we even talking about this? Right? Why is there a big rush to get him to trial before Election Day if Jack Smith is now saying it doesn't matter because the voters already know all of this? So I'm agog watching all of this, but the bottom line is, in terms of how this is going to work in practical reality, Smith knows that there's not going to be a Mar-a-Lago documents case. And I still think if he wanted to push the Mar-a-Lago documents case to trial quickly, he could have by dropping the classified information counts and trying them on. I think there's 8 obstruction counts in the indictment, which would be like over 50 years of criminal exposure. Presumably, he thinks that's enough exposure for Trump, right? So if you wanted to get the case to trial quick, that's what you would do. He's not doing that. So he knows that there's not going to be a trial in the Mar-a-Lago documents case this year, but he's putting down his marker that the 60-day rule is not operative, which means if the Supreme Court decides the immunity case, as I think they're going to decide it, against Trump, And let's say that the New York Times floated that they thought that that decision could come in May. I've been thinking it would come the end of June. Adam Liptak, in his column about it this week, says that, you know, it's possible the court could decide this in May. But everybody who is, almost – I haven't seen any analyst that I pay any attention to who thinks that that Trump's going to win on the immunity in the Supreme Court. But the problem with the immunity right now is that Chutkan can't do anything on the case until the Supreme Court decides the immunity issue. And there's a ton of work that needs to be done to get the January 6th case to trial. There's pretrial motions they have to have hearings on. There's a lengthy jury questionnaire that's got to be developed and sent out to people. That takes a couple of months to work out. So she needs to get moving. If this, if the jurisdiction over the case gets returned to her. And the other thing out there that's of utmost importance is that probably in June, they're going to decide the obstruction case. And that could be a time bomb for Smith's case, because I actually think that the court is probably going to throw out Smith's obstruction charges. And they may, to boot.
By implication?
Yeah, here, just 2 seconds on my theory on this.
Yeah.
I think that the Supreme Court is obviously disturbed by the fact that the Justice Department has taken this statute, which is a Sarbanes-Oxley statute that was meant to address evidence tampering.
Yeah.
And they're applying it to the rioters on the theory that, well, they didn't tamper with evidence at the joint session of Congress, but they prevented the session from happening in the first place. So the argument that's being made in that case is that the defense is saying this is not what this conduct is not what Congress meant this statute to apply to.
Yeah.
And to my mind, it's less problematic to apply the obstruction statute to the rioters than it is to apply it to Trump. Because mm-hmm. what it comes down to in the obstruction statute is, were they acting corruptly? In other words, did they affect or influence a congressional proceeding by corrupt action? And I think if you're talking about a rioter who swings a flagpole at a cop, then you know you're acting corruptly under any definition of what corrupt action is. Whereas in Trump's case, Trump's not implicated in the violence, no matter how much the narrative says he is. So the theory in Trump's case, or Smith's case against Trump, is that Trump knew that John Eastman's legal theory was bogus, and yet he tried to use it to push Pence into invalidating votes. And I don't think the court is going to agree that corruption for purposes of the obstruction statute now includes arguing a frivolous legal theory, because you're going to be indicting lawyers 10 times a week if that's the law.
So why did they need the obstruction under Sarbanes-Oxley with the riot? Why can't you say you rioted, you hit a cop, you trespassed? What was this just adding to the sentencing, or what? Why was it necessary to go down the trial?
It's a 20-year count. Number one, it's a 20-year count. And number two, and this goes to what you wrote about this week, the elephant in the room is they don't have an insurrection case. If you had an insurrection case, then you wouldn't have to worry about any of this, right? You just indict the insurrection case, and then you could say they're insurrectionists. You'd have your Section 3 disqualification already. You'd have people doing time for insurrection. They have to do this extravagant stretching of an obstruction statute that was not meant for this situation, because they don't have insurrection. Because the dirty little secret here that nobody wants to discuss except in the arena of political rhetoric is that what Congress mainly meant by the insurrection statute was the Civil War.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, when they put in the disqualification in Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, they were explicitly talking about the Civil War, right? It was Confederates mm-hmm. that they were talking about. So they don't have in terms of like what happened in the riot, it's not even close to being, factually speaking, anything in comparison to the Civil War. And look, when you see how Jack Smith has stretched these statutes in order to try to apply them in these cases, I mean, a civil rights statute and a fraud statute and the obstruction statute that the Supreme Court obviously has some problems with, the only common sense conclusion you can draw, Rich, is if he conceivably thought he could get Trump convicted of insurrection, he would have indicted it.
Yeah. But again, on the January 6th rioters, not to obsess about this, why couldn't you just do the maximum outer bounds of the penalty for assaulting a cop or for disorderly conduct or for trespassing without having to twist the law in this way?
Because they thought because the Justice Department is carrying out or trying to actuate a Democratic Party narrative, mm-hmm. which is that the January 6th Capitol riot was a 9/11 or Pearl Harbor type event. Mm-hmm. And the problem they have is the crimes that were actually committed that can be proved.
That's not true. So then they have to.
Well, but the thing is, if you're going to have a 9/11 event, then you have to have 9/11 punishment, right?
Mm-hmm, right.
You get the death penalty for multiple mass homicide attacks. If you don't get the death penalty, you know, what did Judge Duffy give the 1993 bombers? Like 240 years apiece? I mean, that's the kind of thing that you get when you have a multiple mass homicide. I had 12 defendants in the blind shake, and the sentences range from 35 years to life plus. Mm-hmm. That's what you get in a real terrorism case. The penalty for parading, which is like a common thing that the Justice Department has brought against the rioters, it's a misdemeanor. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like getting a traffic ticket.
Right.
So their problem is they don't have sentencing that would even approach what would be the kind of case that they're describing this as. And this is why I've gone crazy about this, Rich, from the start. This is why I go nuts when they say 8 police officers lost their lives. No one lost their lives.
Right.
But every single thing about this, they have to exaggerate.
But surely the guys who are assaulting cops, you could put away for a long time without.
Assault on a federal officer for a first offender in a case where the police officer wasn't injured that badly, you know, those sentences are going to run, you know, somewhere between 3 and 8 years, which is pretty much what they've been. But the obstruction statute, I think assault on a federal officer where you don't kill the officer, my recollection is that's like a 5-year,
mm-hmm.
you know, and if it's a serious, like if you kill a federal officer, that's a potential death penalty statute. Yeah. But they don't have any of that here. The thing they like about the obstruction is it's a 20-year statute.
Mm-hmm. So what's the most time anyone's gotten so far? Do you know?
I think the guy who got the leader of the seditious conspiracy have gotten two seditious conspiracy cases that the Proud Boys and the whatever the other one is. But anyway, one guy got 27 years. I think.
Okay. All right.
And the thing is, it's a ridiculous. That guy wasn't even first. Leaving aside that nobody was killed at this thing of the security forces, and that the damage to the Capitol building was so slight that they were able to reconvene that night and ratify Biden's. You know, I'm not trying to belittle this, but I've been in like actual terrorism cases where people got like mass slaughtered. That guy was not even on the premises,
mm-hmm.
at the Capitol, and they gave him 27 years.
Yeah.
But that's an outlier sentence. Most of these sentences have been non-prison sentences.
So we're running a little long here. One last question on this cluster of stuff, and then we should get to the latest in the incredible Fannie Willis drama. But so you don't think the classified documents thing is going? Obviously, Alvin Bragg is going. So what's your forecast on when January 6th case might happen, assuming it's going to get off the ground before the election?
Right after Labor Day.
And you think they'll do that?
I do. And the question's going to be then, there's no doubt my mind, I mean, Smith is as much as, the reason I think this is a big story is Smith is as much as told you, the 60-day, you don't make a to-do about the 60-day rule doesn't apply unless you have it in your mind to have a trial within 60 days of the election, right? I mean, there's no point.
And the rule is just general guidance. It's not as though he's violating some. Yeah. So
Rich, the rule that says the Justice Department is not supposed to take elections into account at all when they make decisions, that is an actual rule. Unlike the 60-day crap, that rule is tells prosecutors you are forbidden from doing that, and he hasn't paid any attention to that one.
Yeah. So, and you're in a criminal trial, you got to show up. You can't just say, you know what, I don't consider this legitimate. I got other important work to do. Come and get me, cop.
Well, in theory, if the judge permits it, most judges wouldn't, you can waive your right to be present. As long as it's knowing and intelligent, you can waive your constitutional rights. Most judges won't let criminal defendants do that. Because what invariably happens, if you let somebody take a day off from trial and they get convicted, then on appeal they say, I was denied my right to be present at my trial.
If you say, I'm not showing up, and the judge says, yes, you are, and you say, no, I'm not, then what happens? Could she just jail you? Or?
Yes, she can hold them in contempt, and then they'll have to work out between the Secret Service and the FBI and the marshals what happens to him. But yes, he'd be in contempt. Of course, you know, Rich, the other thing you have to realize is he may have to be ridded out of Rikers Island because he may already be convicted and sentenced in the Bragg case by the time that all,
you know. They could sentence him to jail in the Bragg case.
No, not really. I mean, look, it's a misdemeanor that he's pretending is 34 felonies. We'll talk more about that. But no, I don't want to say anything is impossible because – everything we've seen, if you had asked me, you know, some time ago, I would have said, nah, that'll never happen. And it's happened. It's like it's our day to day.
All right. So we're at 56 minutes. Let's try to get done before we flip over into triple digits, the hour territory. Really quickly, what do we need to know about Fani Wills?
So the judge ended the hearing last week. And just so everyone knows very quickly, The allegation by the defense is that Fani Willis and Nathan Wade, the prosecutor she hired, were having an affair beginning like 2019, 2020. That's why she hired him. And then she derived financial benefit from having hired him. So that's the ethical allegation. They claim, Fani and Nathan, that they concede that they have a sexual romantic relationship, but that they say it didn't develop until after he was already hired, so that his hiring didn't have anything to do with it. So that's the dispute. And the judge had final arguments about this on Friday. The judge's name is Scott McAfee. And, you know, they brought in a witness named Terrence Bradley. So, Terrence Bradley was Nathan Wade's lawyer. And to make a long story short, the judge said that he didn't have any attorney-client privilege not to report that Nathan Wade told him that they were having an affair, that him and Fani Willis were. So then the defense thought that that was the gold mine they were hoping for, and they put him on the stand, and he hemmed and hawed, and he tried to say, well, I was only speculating. He didn't want to repeat what he said. So that's the state of play. The judge closed the hearing. He said he's going to try to decide it in 2 weeks. Since then, two new witnesses have come forward. One's name is Cindy Lee Yeager. She's a top prosecutor from neighboring Cobb County. This is the circus we're talking about is in Fulton County. And she says that she was in Terrence Bradley's office when not only did he tell her that Nathan and Fani were having an affair that went back to like 2019. But also she was there when Fani called, and Fani was reacting to a newspaper article from September of 2023 that reported in a nefarious tone about all the money that Fannie was paying Nathan Wade. And she says that she heard Fannie tell Terrence Bradley, you don't need to talk to anybody about us. Don't say a word about us. People are coming after us. So it was clear that she, if this is true, that she was trying to discourage Bradley from sharing with anyone what he knew about all of this. Then there's a second witness who's a lawyer, another lawyer, Manny Arora. He's the defense lawyer for a guy named Ken Cheeseborough, who's already pled guilty in the case. He was involved in the so-called alternative or fraudulent electors scheme. He's pled guilty. But Arora says that Bradley told him also that Nathan and Fannie had been having an affair going back to 2019. So that's the state of play. It remains to be seen whether the judge is going to reopen the hearing and let these two new characters testify. And then the other thing, Rich, I just want to quickly add into the mix is a political element that we haven't, we've been treating this as a legal issue, but there's a political element here in that Judge McAfee, this is another one of these districts where the judges are elected, not like the federal system where they're appointed. So Judge McAfee, in a short period of time, I think it's a matter of weeks, is up for re-election in Fulton County. And I just think it's impossible not to wonder, depending on, I'm not at all familiar with how this is working down there, but I don't know if like Fannie Willis is polling well in Atlanta, or if this has been a catastrophe.
Maybe her numbers have gone up.
Well, or maybe it's one of these situations where it's like us against them, tribal politics,
sure. Absolutely.
And her followers are the only ones. These are very low turnout elections.
Mm-hmm.
So the question is, does the judge think he can afford to bounce her if he wants to stay a judge? I don't know the answer to that.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's all the time we have. This podcast has been produced by the incomparable Sarah Schutte. Thanks, everyone, for listening. And thank you, Andy McCarthy.
Thanks, Rich.